Case number 24-5172. Monty Arrows Jr. et al. Versus Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Secretary, United States Department of Health and Human Services in his official capacity et al. Indiana Family and Social Services Administration appellant. Mr. Barta for the appellant, Mr. Boldy for appellees Robert F. Kennedy Jr. et al., Mr. Ed for appellees Monty Rose Jr. et al.
Good morning.
May it please the court. The Healthy Indiana Plan, or HIP, expanded Medicaid to cover hundreds of thousands of Hoosiers while allowing all beneficiaries who make small, predictable contributions to power accounts to access benefits that traditional Medicaid does not provide, like vision and dental, and to avoid making unpredictable time-of-service copayments that would apply under traditional Medicaid. The Secretary reasonably determined that HIP would likely advance Medicaid's goals of allowing Indiana to continue providing greater coverage than would otherwise exist. In vacating the waiver, the District Court made three principal errors. First, it moved the statutory baseline for assessing projects, requiring the Secretary to explain why HIP was better than hypothetical alternatives rather than just why it would likely advance the statute's objectives. Second, it shifted its focus from the project as a whole to individual elements of that project. And third, it imposed a remedy that not only fails to redress the injuries alleged, but whose disruptive effects are out of proportion to the alleged error. But before I get to the merits, let me first address this court's jurisdiction. In assessing the finality of orders, the Supreme Court has told us we must take a practical view of finality. And when it comes to remand orders, this court has made clear that two types of orders that may be labeled a remand order are nonetheless final. Orders that effectively terminate the action, or orders where there is a danger that the party injured would not have an opportunity to appeal later. And here we have both. As for the effectively terminating the action, the order vacates the 2020 approval, giving plaintiffs full relief on count one. And there is nothing the district court could do with respect to count one of the complaint, because all that count one challenges is the 2020 approval, not individual elements of that approval.
That's going to be true often in remands. That is exactly what the plaintiffs asked for. So in that sense, it'll be full relief. But it's the whole rationale of this doctrine is that, well, we'll see what you get on remand. They're going to revisit the issue. And either side, Indiana, as well as the other side, will have the opportunity to challenge that decision once it issues.
There will be a new decision on remand, but any future litigation about that decision is not about the 2020 approval. And I think that's one of the critical—
Why does that matter?
So I think that's one of the—in two ways, Your Honor. First, as to when we're looking what effectively terminates the action, we first have to ask, what is the claim on which the district court entered the Rule 54B judgment? And the claim here, as the district court noted, is about the 2020 approval and that approval only, not individual elements who can continue to be disputed or litigated on remand. And I think the second reason goes into, can this effectively be reviewed later? Here, any future litigation is going to concern the new agency action. And
I think the concern is that your argument just describes the exact prototypical case we've said isn't appealable. Every time a district court vacates an action and remands to see if that same action can be justified, that's sort of the baseline situation in which we say it's not appealable. So I think you need a reason that this case is different from that, don't you?
So I think there are two reasons. The first goes to, does this effectively terminate the action? I think given how the boundaries of the actual claim at issue count one, that this is very much like the American Great Lakes case, where there was going to be continued litigation about the rulemaking, but because of how the count on appeal was framed, the court said the order effectively terminated the action with respect to that count. And as to the, the second piece of it, which is the, can this be appealed later? Yes, there may be future litigation about HIP in general, but not the 2020 remand. There's a chance that any future litigation about this may not even occur in this circuit if there is a denial on remand.
But after the remand, if you want to appeal, you can appeal the new proceedings after remand, and you can also appeal the remand order that said it there. So I don't understand why you wouldn't be able to appeal this later.
So I don't think that's true if there is a denial of the approval on remand, because Indiana would be entitled to challenge that in the Southern or Northern District of Indiana. Any appeals would go to the Seventh Circuit. And at that point, I think this action would likely be moot. There would be nothing further to do, nothing further that the district court could set aside.
Precedent for that? Because I don't think that's the way it works. And I think we have precedents that say that you can challenge the remand order.
So I think we cite a Seventh Circuit case in our brief. I think Travis is the name that sort of says that when you have a new agency action, at least in the Seventh Circuit, they're going to consider the old agency action, any litigation about that moot. And I think that shows exactly the dilemma we are in.
It's not uncommon, and this happens often during presidential transitions, that matters are sent back to agencies because the agency says, as I have here, we're going to look at this again. And especially if they say, we're going to make a new decision, as they have here. At a bare minimum, we would hold the case in abeyance rather than rule upon it, because it's a waste for us to issue what everyone knows is going to be an advisory opinion on the lawfulness of agency action A, when they've already said, forget about it. We're going to do agency action B. So I don't understand why we would spend the resources and then, either they come out with a decision before we do, at which point it's all wasted, or we come out of it right before they do, at which point it's all wasted.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that goes maybe to a prudential concern about whether you set briefing in a case or not, but not the issue of finality, which is determined at the time the agency action issues.
Are you happy if we just hold it in abeyance?
Your Honor, I don't
know how that helps the concerns that you're raising. So it seems to me it gets to the practicality. You're talking about a practical effects doctrine here. And if it makes no sense for us to reach out and rule under the arguments that you're advancing, which simply sort of echo the problems with this remand rule.
So I think, Your Honor, that would go to some of the practical concerns about, what happens with future, do you lose the chance to appeal at all? But I don't think it addresses other practical concerns.
What do you think would happen to that appeal if we hold it in abeyance and then they issue a whole new decision?
Well, I think
what are the chances we would then say, well, we still need to decide this? Of course we wouldn't.
Well, if it's a denial, I think the court would need to decide this appeal because that is the.
No, we would advance. We would. There's no point to that. You. It would get you nowhere. You would still have to do with denial B. It would do nothing to remedy your injury if we say maybe they were wrong about denial A, that it was actually perfectly lawful because they now have a whole new decision in place.
And then if there's a denial, that litigation might not even occur in this court, which means the district.
I don't understand what the relevance of that point is.
Well, I think it goes to the district court's decision not being effectively reviewed, including, and I think this is significant.
That would be your choice. I mean, this is, or the plaintiff's choice, whoever's choice it is. There's no guarantee that every district court decision ultimately gets reviewed if parties choose to challenge a subsequent agency action somewhere else. That's just how the world works.
Well, Your Honor, I think that we're not saying that every ruling that might come in the course of a case can immediately be appealed, but rather, one of the significant pieces about this is not just a remand. It vacates the agency action. So there are going to be consequences
What rule are you actually asking us to adopt here? Are you saying that all remands that vacate agency action are not final? Because in general, remands are not final decisions. So what are you saying? Is it because Indiana is a state? Is it because any remand where an agency action is vacated is now final in your view? Like what exactly are you asking us to hold?
So
this is not just your case. This is going to affect a lot of other cases.
So the rule that we think is that most accurately captures this is where there is a district court decision that vacates an agency action and the complaint and the relevant count before this court is attacking that specific agency action, it is final and appealable.
That is a very routine thing that happens in this court. So you're saying that all of these remands, any remand that vacates agency action is non-final. Even though it's being remanded, going back to the agency, there's going to be more stuff happening, but it's final. If it vacates the prior agency action, that's not final in every case in that posture.
So I don't think so, Your Honor. And I think that's just the line between maybe the Pueblo of San Vista case and the American Great Lakes case is it depends on the not just whether vacatur occurs, but vacatur and how the claim at issue is defined.
So it depends on the remedy. It depends on vacatur.
Vacatur plus what is the scope of the claim that is at issue? And here, the scope of the claim is specific to a particular action on a particular date, not everything that could be litigated about the HIP program. And I think, you know,
a very difficult rule for us to adopt and implement.
Well, if there are concerns with that, I think we have a narrower fallback rule.
I guess my question is, why would we do this?
Well, I think one of the reasons is because specifically when we're talking about Medicaid, you have a state that is not an ordinary party. It's part of
a Medicaid-specific rule you're asking for?
So I think if the court is uncomfortable with the broader rule I just proposed, it would be permissible to have a rule for cooperative federalism programs in which you have an agreement between two sovereigns and both are equally impacted by vacatur of it. So I think that would be the narrow rule. And
But you're not equally impacted because you can still appeal later after the remand, whereas the government couldn't, the agency couldn't.
Well,
that's
I think
the whole basis of the rules that we have in place.
Well, I think that as the dialogue with Judge Millett illustrates, there is not a non-zero risk Indiana wouldn't be able to litigate this case to conclusion. And that's exactly what the government faces whenever it has a remand. It may well just issue a decision on remand that gets challenged, and the government can then litigate the validity of its original action in any subsequent appeal, but there is no guarantee. And that is precisely the problem that we're trying to avoid when it comes to practical finality.
Can I ask you about the practical finality? So if the district court had just remanded without vacatur, what's your position on jurisdiction?
I think we'd be in a very different position.
Of course you are. That's why I asked the question. So I just want to know yes or no.
So if it's remand without vacatur, I don't think we would be here.
Oh, that's not a legal answer at all. Analyze finality under the test you wish us to apply in a scenario where the district court's decision was just a remand.
So I think there it depends on the scope of the claim. If the claim
this
is
case, if it
so
was
this case,
remand.
I still think there would be a final decision because the claim is specific to the 2020 approval. And so we're very much the situation as if the government wanted to appeal. There's no dispute. I don't think that would be final and appealable. So I think we are very much in the same position. Now, in terms of whether there is the same need to appeal, that may not be always the case.
Well, that's Indiana's decision on whether it needs to appeal. So your position doctrinally is not limited to vacatur situation. And you say it's because there's a final resolution of a particular agency action, 2022 approval, which is going to happen 100% of the time when there's a remand. There has to be a final decision on whatever is being remanded.
So, and to be clear, I think this court's established there's two branches of remand orders that are final. One is effectively terminates the action, and that doesn't depend on the remedy imposed. And the second is, is there a meaningful chance to appeal later? And that, I think, is where the vacatur comes in.
Effectively terminates the action is a really weird argument when there's a 54B certification.
Well,
that you sought, because the whole point of 54B is that the action is not effectively terminated. This claim, particular claim, or this claim as to this party is terminated, and it makes no sense to wait for everything else.
So I think yes, Your Honor. I think when I say effectively terminates the action, it's with respect to the claims on which the district court entered judgment.
Okay, well then that is 100% of remand orders, because as to the judgment that's remanded, it will be a decision that there was error by the agency that warrants vacature, or may not vacature, but warrants remand and action by the agency. That action cannot survive unless the agency fixes whatever problem was identified. So I think now we're back in the area Judge Penn was worried about of how we would distinguish this case in a way that wouldn't be now not just remands with vacature, but 100% of remands.
So I think if that is the court's concern, you know, what I would direct the court to is a more narrow rule that addresses this case is where you have vacatur of an agency action impacting a bilateral agreement between two sovereigns, either sovereign, the federal government or the state can appeal.
Okay. And then I wanted to ask you, in that situation, you have put a lot of weight on vacature. And I think for your narrower approach, that's what you're asking us to focus on. In this case, the district court has stayed its vacature order, not just during appeal, but during the remand proceedings, which is about as unvacated a vacature as I can conceive of. And you have pointed out in a letter, well, there is no stay as to the power accounts. That's because you asked for that in your joint motion for a stay from the district court. You agreed to the power accounts not being stayed. So given that the vacature has no practical operation, except in one capacity where you agreed a stay was not needed, what practical effect could we lean on here to say that this one should be treated as final?
So I think when we're assessing finality, it's at the time the order is issued.
This court's practice. We have assessed finality based on representations and oral argument. And we have that in an opinion. So that binds us.
So I think that goes.
And if you're going to do a practical effects analysis, really, we're going to ignore the most relevant practical effects on which you're leaning on, the consequences of vacature for a partner in a cooperative federal state agreement?
So, Your Honor, to address that more directly, one is when the parties sort of agreed on the contours of a limited stay, it was without prejudice to either party's ability to seek further review. And second, the further review
needed. You've been allowed to seek further review. You surely cannot stipulate as to how we will decide any issue on that appeal. Had to know that going in.
No, Your Honor, and that's precisely why
you're a smart attorney. You were aware of the remand rule, so you knew what risks you were assuming.
Well, Your Honor, and that goes precisely to the second piece, which is right now Indiana cannot operate the cornerstone of its HIP program power account.
It's the count because you agreed to not have those stayed. That's a you problem, the state of Indiana, not you personally, but that's an Indiana strategic tactical choice and litigation problem. It's also a little hard to call it the cornerstone when it hasn't functioned for 5 years. So maybe five and a half at this point. So I'm not sure what we're supposed to do with that. Are we supposed to relieve Indiana of its strategic litigation decision and then use that as a basis for finding either a narrow or a broad exception to our remand finality rule?
How we see the issue, Your Honor, is it goes, if at all, to mootness rather than finality. And the case is not moot because there's still a live dispute as to whether Indiana...
Sorry, what goes to mootness rather than finality?
The stay goes to mootness rather than finality in our view.
I thought you wanted us to do a practical effects analysis here. That's the only way we get into we can do it because that's where the exceptions to the remand finality rule are. They're practical effects analysis. And so I don't think it just goes to mootness. I think practical effects goes to the practical effects, and it's hard for you to lean on a practical effect as absolutely essential when you agreed you didn't need a stay of that.
Well, there are two practical effects. One is it's going to inform what the government does on remand in terms of the rule it applies, and that's precisely what the government can use to appeal these types of orders. And second,
the court's decision is going to inform what the agency does on remand.
Correct, Your Honor.
That's 100% of remands.
And that is the exact situation which this court has held the federal government can appeal. And we think when there is a federal state agreement, the same rule should apply to the state as to the federal government. And in terms of...
But why is that when you can still appeal and the federal government can't? I guess you had said in the Seventh Circuit, maybe you couldn't. But our case law says you can appeal the remand order after the remand. And it's your choice where you bring your appeal, right? So you can just appeal here, and then you can appeal a remand order.
So, Your Honor, one thing we can't, and maybe this helps, is one thing that is, I think there's no dispute that no party can appeal after the remand, is the decision not just to remand, but to vacate the order for the duration of that remand. That has to be appealed now or not at all, because however long any remand takes, and this is true in any category of cases, the court can't undo the vacater for the period, for the years in which the remand in any subsequent district court litigation, any future appeals may take.
But if it's a non-event vacater, which is what we have here, a stayed.
It's a stayed vacater.
I don't even know what your injury is.
I think
you don't have to change anything you're doing in Indiana.
We do, Your Honor. There, in order to continue operating HIP without power accounts, the legislature had to enact a temporary piece of legislation that allowed continued operation.
Was that this year or was that in 2020?
2025.
Okay. Well, so they've enacted the legislation, so we're good.
No, Your Honor.
But you hadn't been operating them for 5 years anyhow because of the pandemic. You haven't been operating. When's the last time you operated one of these power premiums?
That was before COVID, and the whole reason that we didn't operate them during that time was temporary legislative changes.
We're a lot of years past COVID. I mean, still with us, but COVID crisis, pandemic. And Indiana still chose not to reinstate these power premiums.
Your Honor, we could not under the terms of an enhanced federal funding package.
That's a choice. Indiana can say no to money.
Certainly. And the agreement was we will not reinstate them while during COVID and any redetermination period, not forever. And now we're in the situation of asking, is this a forever thing or is this just a temporary COVID era thing?
Okay. And you have said Indiana made the choice that, well, we'll keep doing what we've been doing, no power accounts, while this litigation goes forward and the case is remanded. So Indiana has already made the choice. I feel like I'm repeating myself here that we can do just fine without, maybe it's not our ideal dream, but we can do just fine operating our program as we have for the last 5 years until the remand is over. At which point, it's up to HHS what they want to do about these power premiums. And if it's going to, you say, influence their decision, then you will have an argument if it influences it in a way you don't like. And then you don't want to argue about this one here. You're going to want to argue about the operative decision and say, what were they doing? They were listening to this, in your view, erroneous district court decision. And it's arbitrary and capricious for them to have done whatever they do. That will be your argument. Or they will make a decision and you will be happy as a clam. And Indiana will have nothing to complain about.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that question gets to one of the lingering practical effects. It is a world of difference under an arbitrary and capricious deferential framework, whether you are the party challenging the decision or whether you are the party defending it. Here, we are the party defending it. If there's a new adverse decision, Indiana would be the party challenging it.
Here's the one where you are challenging it. You want this litigation to go forward where you have to challenge. I assume you'd be happier to defend on the next round if you like the agency's decision.
Well, to be clear, I'm talking about, there's a difference between challenging the agency decision, not the district court decision.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but it's applying the same arbitrary and capricious review that we do.
But as this is a deferential standard, if you are the party challenging the 2020 approval,
I don't disagree that you're happier as an appellee or respondent in any of these types of cases, but I'm not sure that's a justification for finality. Can I ask you a fact question?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
How many folks in Indiana are enrolled in the HIP program? I assume you won't. I'll be very impressed if you have the precise number today, but just roughly.
I think roughly about 600,000.
Okay. All right. And do you know what the current status of your application for another 5-year extension on a substance use disorder mental health program is
still pending, Your Honor.
Okay. Okay. Can I ask you, I don't know if my colleagues have other questions or.
I have another question, but please finish.
Okay. While HIP 2 has 2.0, I guess you call it, has been in effect, how many individuals have been either denied enrollment because they couldn't make an upfront premium payment or have been kicked out for not making premium payments?
So when we're answering that question, we have to distinguish between two periods of time. One is between 2015 and 2018, mm-hmm. in which there was a different version of HIP, mm-hmm. and then from 2018 to 2020 before COVID sort of derailed everything, because in 2018, the state made a couple of changes to simplify power counts that and to recalculate how contributions are done such that for most people, it dropped substantially.
I just would like to know.
Yeah. So before
total amount of people that have been kicked off.
So before the 2020 Levin report notes, I think there were in the 2018 to 2019 period, there were mm-hmm. about 5,000 that were kicked off, and that's about 1.4% of the total HIP population.
So 5,000 kicked off, but how many tried to enroll but couldn't? Because I take it you have to pay a premium to actually get your first premium to get enrolled.
Yeah, so for the 2018 to 2019 period, there is no data on how many people did not enroll for because of the contributions, but that was precisely one of the things that the 2020 report noted would need to be studied going forward because you couldn't rely on 20.
It's a long time since 2019, so what's the study results? How many people?
So the 2019 to 2020 data is not in, is. I'm not aware of anything in the record that specifically addresses how many people tried to, you know, were interested in enrolling but did not. But if you look at page
2018 to 2020 is what I'm interested in. You said you were going to do a study of this.
Yeah,
period,
so
it would cover that.
If you look at page 1037 of the joint appendix, mm-hmm. it you know, provides the data on how many people were disenrolled in that period mm-hmm. for failure to make contributions. It was 5,500 members. That's against a population of about, I think it was about 50. You know, over 500,000 at that time.
Sorry, 5,500.
Were disenrolled for failure to make contributions.
Right, that's still at 5,500. I had 5,000 from you. Okay. But we still don't have, you don't have the number or it's just not in the record, but Indiana does have a number for how many people were rejected from enrollment in the first.
It's not in the record and I'm not aware of the data.
I thought you said they were doing a study.
No, the report indicated that that data would need to be analyzed. I'm not aware of whether the report actually was completed with respect to that, you know, data category.
Is there any reason to think it's lower than the 5,500? This seems really, I mean, really, I just really you're doing this program in which enrollment is an absolutely essential feature and you're not keeping track of how many people are not allowed to enroll because of your, this was a whole point of the experiment is to test how this works. And so you have to know how many people, not you personally again, but you have to know how many people couldn't enroll because of the requirement to pay premiums. Otherwise, this isn't an experiment at all. And that's a whole nother reason for HHS to be concerned about reauthorization.
So, Your Honor, I think part of this is a timing issue. The 2020 report comes out in April of 2020, at which point there is no longer premiums being charged. And it's, you know, sort of analyzing retrospectively data from 2018 and 2019. I am not aware of whether there was a survey conducted in 2018, 2019 before COVID interrupted things as to whether people wished to enroll but did not because of premiums. The only data we have from that is before 2018, in which at which point Indiana made significant changes to the power account structure to lower premiums.
Not the practice of refusing to enroll people who couldn't pay premiums. That did not change.
Correct, Your Honor. Okay. That did not change, but
what are the pre-2018 statistics?
So pre-2018, And if you look at, the secretary talks about this on page 856 of the joint appendix, that there was 3.1% did not enroll for failure to make, or were disenrolled for failure to make contributions in 2016. That went down to 2.2%
in 2018. How many were not allowed to enroll in the first place?
I think one survey had a number of about 26,000 over a, I think, 18-month period.
Okay. But, and that survey is a Indiana report, something they commissioned?
It was an evaluation, yes.
Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you. So on the question of whether you would have the opportunity to appeal the remand order after the remand, I had asked you about that because our case law says that you most certainly can do that. And you had responded that the thing that's actually final is the vacator. And it just seems to me that if the thing that's final is the vacator, why would you get to actually challenge the remand order, which is what you're trying to do here? And on the vacator order, we have a whole sort of set of legal standards for vacator. And in this case, there was arguments about disruption, et cetera, which is certainly something that that should be considered. And the district court considered that and stayed the vacator. So it just seems to me, number one, you're here trying to appeal the remand order when the only thing that you're actually saying is final is the vacator. But in this particular case, the vacator has no real effect. So any arguments you would have had about vacator, just really carry no water here because it's all been stayed.
So there's not a separate remand and vacator order, Your Honor. They're part of the same order. It vacates and remands. As to the practical effects, we do think that, you know, the unable to appeal later, that's one branch of this court's cases, and that's where the vacator is significant.
But you have to meet that standard. And so I guess there's two parts of it for you, one being that you're conceding that you can appeal the remand order later. I guess you have to concede that because that's our case law. So the only thing you're relying on is the vacator. But the vacator's been stayed.
It's been partly stayed, Your Honor. And then as to the, but that's
as
only Lett one.
Said, the only reason it's partial is because that's what you asked for.
Yeah, but I think that's only one branch of the cases. The other is, does it resolve the distinct claim in a way that.
But you have to meet both.
No, I think these are two separate cases, lines of cases. On the one hand, you have cases like, long distance telephone exchange, which is talking about, can you appeal later or not in cases that allow the government to appeal when a private party might not be able to? And then you have the branch of cases like the American Great Lakes case that where all the parties agreed there would be future remand proceedings on the very rule that the plaintiffs were challenging. But this court said that the plaintiffs could appeal in that case because with respect to, part of the rule, there wouldn't be significant future proceedings with respect to that piece. And that's where we are here.
No direction for the agency to act in the Great Lakes case. There's no direction for them to act and no reason to think that they were going to act. We've got the antithesis of this here because the agency has said, we're on it. We're going to issue a new decision.
So, Your Honor, I think that may just go to how you're defining the claim.
But it isn't like American Great Lakes. It doesn't fall within that exception.
But I think, and this maybe just brings back to, I think, what is the narrowest way to resolve that when you have an order that remands or vacates and remands either way that agency
does the narrowest way. So you better
an agreement between two sovereigns, the federal government and the states, either party, the states or the federal government can appeal.
Even when the two sovereigns agreed to have it stayed.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I think we've kept you up a little bit longer. Thank you so much. We'll give you some time for rebuttal.
May it please the court, Max Obaldi for the federal appellees. My friend offered, I think, four different potential rules for why this case might be appealable now, why there might be appellate jurisdiction. I don't think any of them work, but I want to talk through them. The first was the idea that if there is vacatur and final resolution of a claim, but this case has a lot of this court has a lot of cases. Pueblo Sandy is a great example where there's vacatur and remand, and there's still no appellate jurisdiction because that is inherently an interlocutory order, and it can come back and be resolved, and the remand order will merge into the final judgment.
Why isn't it? I mean, we have this strange exception that the government can appeal for practical reasons. It doesn't become any more final when it's the government versus Indiana appealing. But in the area of these cooperative state-federal programs, where essentially what has been invalidated is a contractual agreement between the government and a state. And so the state's half of that contract is just as much broken as the federal government's. And if you had true, actual vacature in effect, you know, you all are making your decision making, but you could have a state that's left with no Medicaid program, and it's going to have to deal with that while the remand is ongoing before the agency. And that would be extraordinarily disruptive. And you could halt a Medicaid program, could throw it into turmoil. Why wouldn't, if we had actual vacatur effects in a case involving, so you'd have to have a remand with vacatur, there'd have to actually be vacatur effects, and it involves a cooperative state federal program where what is vacated is the contractual arrangement. Why wouldn't it make just as much sense to allow the state, whose ox really is deeply gored in that situation, to appeal just as much as the U.S. government? Because whatever they appeal they can have later, they will have dealt with a year or two of having to completely reorder and revamp their entire system, or just not have Medicaid for a year or so.
Yeah, let me address that in two parts. First, through the premise that Indiana might not have Medicaid, they would still have a state Medicaid plan. They would not be able to run their demonstration program, and there might be features under state law that require them to change some things, but, you know, I don't think it's accurate to say that Medicaid would disappear in Indiana.
Maybe I'm wrong. If you have a demonstration program, at least one like here that is what made the whole expansion possible, that's a lot of change. Let's assume their basic plan would just go forward. There's still tens of thousands, maybe 100,000 people that are thrown off, in their view. Again, assuming there are actual vacature here. Let's imagine a different state, an actual vacature order that's not stayed. And as a result, 100,000 people who have been able to receive Medicaid under the experimental program will immediately be thrown off when that experiment goes away. Can they appeal to or not?
I think that would be a compelling reason for the district court to remand without vacatur or to stay a vacatur order. But
if that hasn't happened, why aren't they? This is a practical effects. The only reason the government gets appeal is practical effects. And so why would
not? I'm not quite sure that's true. So in Pueblo of Sandia, this court described the rule that the government gets to appeal and that exception is an application of the collateral order doctrine, right? It said remand rules as a category are not final, but because there's an asymmetry, the federal agency gets to appeal because there's no way for it to take the case back to court.
But it's just definitely not meeting the Cohen factors because it is not separable from the merits. It is the merits that you're appealing.
Well, no. What we're appealing on remand, what's being appealed on remand is this question of, you know, what standard we need to apply or what extra, what additional explanation we need
to
apply.
The merits of the case. This is count one in the case. So you can't, this, if you were, had chosen to appeal on the merits, then you would be arguing the merits of the district court's decision and of the ruling on count one of the complaint, would you not?
So,
in fact, you have done that in your brief here.
I understand what you're saying. I can't change the analysis that this court has in its precedents calling an application of the collateral order doctrine. Problem.
That's on us. Yeah. But it's not, I don't know that we can sort of say Indiana's out just by looking at Cohen factors.
So then I would point to, if you're talking about the practicality and you're looking at why The rationale for why the federal government gets to appeal here is not that it has, it's that it's a sovereign or that it has a particularly strong interest or that there would be particular effects. The rationale is done sort of on a categorical, not case-by-case basis, and it's based on the idea that the agency can't challenge its own actions complying with the remand order. So if the agency thinks on remand it's been instructed to do something contrary to the statute, and it has to comply with that order, and it reaches a new decision and puts it out, it might just be stuck with that. If no other party brings that to court.
Can we separate the vacature from the substance of the remand order? Like, why doesn't a vacature order meet the Cohen factors? It's conclusive. It resolves an important question if thousands of people are going to be thrown off Medicaid, and it's effectively unreviewable on appeal. Like, why can't a vacature order be appealed?
I don't think it's accurate to say that it's effectively unreviewable on appeal. It would, you know, all interlocutory orders merge into a final judgment. And here's...
But it's effectively unreviewable because once you vacated it, by the time you come back after remand, all these people have lost their...
So I would look insurance. To the example of like a preliminary injunction, which Congress had to create a separate provision. It needed 1292A to make preliminary injunctions appealable. It wasn't just they fit into 1291 because they're effective, you know, the effect of the preliminary injunction halting some action during the pendency of litigation is
preliminary injunctions final. Are hard to fit under Cohen. I'm just saying, why don't vacature orders fit under Cohen?
Well, I'm saying I think they're in many ways they're analogous, right? It's a coercive order telling in
well, preliminary injunctions have deal with the merits, whereas a vacature order has a sort of a different set of legal things that are more based on practical effects. It's like the allied signal test is not based on the merits of the action, whereas preliminary injunctions are. So it's separable. It's an important question separate from the merits.
I suppose. If we were to look at this sort of order, which in the same sentence or two sentences in a row vacates and remands, what I would say is that you look at cases where you have vacatur and remand, like Pueblo of Sandia, and the court has reached the same result and said that these are separate, that the fact that there's sort of two dispositions doesn't change the fact that it is a remand order. And here's the point
maybe they didn't make the argument there that the vacature has all the effects that this one does.
I mean, it in that case, it
so I guess we would have to look at this. If it's Cohen, it would have to be categorical. So we would have to say vacature orders are a category of things.
Right.
That it's important that we allow.
And that's another reason why I think the cooperative federalism idea doesn't work, because that's sort of being party specific and it's specific to the, you know, equities of a case. Again, a great reason to stay a vacatur or to not vacate, but not necessarily sort of the categorical analysis that wouldn't just open up a whole wide swath of orders coming up every time.
Is practical finality different or the same as Cohen? Because we've already talked about you got a huge problem if the government even appealing if we have to go through the Cohen factors. I don't know that the Supreme Court has said that's how we look at practical finality. But maybe you've got a better read on it.
So, I mean, I think we don't go through it in every case because this court has just said as a category, this exception exists. And, you know, if we were to litigate it from first principles.
There's 0% of times where that the government appealing the merits of the district court's decision would be separable from the merits.
Let me give you an example that I think might work. So take a FOIA case where there's an issue of adequacy of the search and it's remanded for a new search and the government appeals. That is not the ultimate merits question of whether the government has, you know, disclosed documents properly, made proper withholding. It's a question of sort of this partial question of what sort of search needs to be done. It's not
a
final resolution.
That's the merits issues we decide in FOIA cases all the time.
It's a merits issue, but it's not a sort of the final end-all be-all merits question, right? You would still have a whole lot of other analysis in a FOIA case. And I'm suggesting
that... Someone ever said we look... I'm not even sure how we decide what the final be-all end-all question is, because the answer to what documents you get is going to depend on what process the agency did or is supposed to do. So I'm not sure I understand that test. I'm just actually more doctrinal question. I know this is, yeah. This is, I mean, we've all been wrestling with this, I think, but I just, it seemed like your approach was that there is no practical finality doctrine. There's finality and there's Cohen. Are there three categories or two? Is it finality, Cohen, practical finality, or just two?
I think you can look at finality in a practical way, and there are cases where, you know, the kind of cases where courts wrestle with practical finality are things like the court has resolved most of the case, but there's like a lingering fees issue, and there's been any number of Supreme Court cases trying to figure out what sort of fees qualify. There are Supreme Court cases about, you know, when they review state court judgments and the state Supreme Court sends it back to the state trial court for entry of judgment. The state court has said that's practically final. I don't think that's the sort of circumstance we have here where, again, the district court resolved very little here. It certainly said that this was that the approval wasn't adequately justified, that the secretary didn't look at the data and explain his decision in enough depth. But the district court also said, I'm not looking to the reasonableness of the decision. I'm not looking to the underlying data. I'm reaching this decision solely on the basis that there's just not enough here in this explanation. Go back and try again. And the agency has said that it will go back and reevaluate it. And that's, you know, I think it's a classic remand. And to the extent that we're talking about the practical finality in this case by itself, I think, Judge Millett, as you pointed out, the stay of the vacatur does a lot of work there, because there really aren't practical effects other than the ability to charge premiums for power accounts and HIP Plus.
Can I just ask you to clarify what you think the rule is that our cases announce? You're basically saying that, and this might be right, the practical consequences, bad, good, indifferent, are just irrelevant to the question of appealability. The question is just, can you appeal after further proceedings on remand? And that's the end of the story.
I think that is correct for the appealability of a remand order. The exceptions that exist are the government, the federal agency that rendered a decision, can appeal because it would have no other opportunity to seek judicial review. That's Sierra Club, Occidental Petroleum. There's the exception for when the only task left is ministerial. There's a remand with sort of instructions and there's nothing left to do. But I don't think that.
Yeah. So we also have this stray. I understand that. We also have this language in our cases suggesting that it's okay because the party who's appealing now can appeal the remand order later. And it seems to me it's really hard to understand in practical terms what that means in a case like this. This doesn't mean necessarily this becomes appealable, but anytime you remand for more explanation, and then the agency gives a new explanation and either grants or denies what the party wants, they're not going to appeal and in this case come back and say, well, don't worry about why they denied it in 2026. They gave enough reasons in 2020. There's no way we would approach that case that way, would we?
Well, so there's the district court's analysis binds the agency. The agency can't go back and say, we're going to ignore your order. And so.
And later, Indiana can't come to court and say, don't worry about anything that happened on remand. You just need to rule that the district court in 2024 was wrong. The initial approval was okay, and forget everything else that happens.
That's correct. But Indiana can say in that challenge, the agency's decision in, imagine that it went back to the agency and the agency rejected the application. Indiana could bring it back to court and say, you know, we think that the agency was wrong to challenge it, but it could also on appeal say the agency flipped its position and got it wrong because it was bound by this faulty remand order where the governing legal rule that it was required to apply was wrong. That's how it brings it back to court.
The position doesn't make the agency wrong.
No, but Your Honor, if the agency would have,
the agency could approve or not.
Yes, and I'm just suggesting that the option be open to Indiana to argue that the agency was boxed in by this rule of decision that was simply wrong, and that's what it applied. My only point is that these questions can come back to court. That is the point I'm trying to make.
That one can't. I mean, the point is, as Judge Garcia was saying, is that if we come up here on a new decision where the agency has done a whole bunch of analysis and given, you know, an ideal reasoned explanation for a decision to disapprove, we wouldn't say
you have to approve. All we would say is, well, was that reason? We wouldn't go back and go, even if the prior one was perfectly reasoned as well and the district court was wrong, that really doesn't matter, does it, as long as the decision before us is reasoned?
So let me take an example from this case where the district court, you know, I want to be careful to not box in how the agency interprets the district court's order, but I think there's a way to read the district court's order to say that the agency shouldn't be looking to health effects. I'm not trying to take a position whether that's what it in fact says. If the secretary were to enter a new decision and say, well, I can't consider health effects under the terms of the remand order, and therefore I don't think there's enough here to enter an approval, that's the sort of thing that Indiana could challenge. But yes, with every case that is remanded to get a new decision, to get further explanation for additional proceedings, there is a new decision and you will look to that decision. But
you're basically saying if there's a wrong legal issue that the district court determined that guides the remand, then Indiana will be able to challenge that.
That's correct.
As part of the,
that's correct.
You know what they also could have done is ask for a 1292B certification if there actually were a controlling question of law in this case like that.
Yes, that is that's the mechanism Congress created for this type of issue.
Can I ask you two questions? One just factual. Do you know what the status of HHS's review on the remand is, or if there's any, may not, but if there's any rough timetable or anything like
that? So I know that it is before them, and I understand that at the moment they are waiting to see how this plays out. I'm not representing that they won't act because they haven't told me what they're going to do one way or another.
Are they acting on waivers during the shutdown at all?
I don't believe so, but I actually...
So they're waiting for two things now.
Yeah, they're waiting for a couple of things.
Okay. And do you have more questions? I was really curious about two-thirds of your brief are spent on the merits, arguing that if we do find jurisdiction, we should vacate the district court's order. Did you guys file a notice of appeal?
No.
I'm assuming you and the Justice Department are acutely aware of boundless precedent from the Supreme Court and this court, holding that a party that wishes to change the judgment of the district court has to either file a notice of appeal or cross appeal?
Yes, Your Honor.
It has to get that filing approved and authorized by the Solicitor General. Has the Solicitor General authorized that part of your brief?
The Solicitor General has reviewed the brief, yes.
Has the Solicitor General authorized an appeal?
No, the government did not appeal.
Then you can't. Why is that? What is your rationale for why that argument is there without filing an appeal? Notice of appeal.
So, Your Honor, the government is not seeking to invoke this court's jurisdiction to disturb the judgment of the district court.
That's a conclusion of your brief.
What we are saying is that if you were to reach the merits, that we are presenting our views
on
the proper way.
If we find jurisdiction.
Yes. If you find jurisdiction, if some party has invoked the jurisdiction of this court.
You had to file a conditional cross appeal. I mean, Supreme Court's held 100 times. A party can't stand there at that podium and ask us to change the district court's judgment without filing a notice of appeal or cross appeal or petition, whatever the case may be. And you don't get around that. This isn't an alternative ground for affirmance that you're advocating. And if the Solicitor General is going to do that, Solicitor General has to own it and sign a piece of paper that says appeal or cross appeal and make that final decision. I don't care if someone in the office reviewed it. It has to be authorized. And you're telling me that that argument to change the district court's judgment was not authorized by the Solicitor General.
I am telling you that there is not a, you know, slip order in the archives in OSG saying I authorize
appeal
in this case.
It's not an authorization by the Solicitor General to seek to overturn the decision of a district court. Conditionally or otherwise.
Your Honor, the government has not appealed.
Two-thirds of your brief is an argument that we define as an appeal. Please change the district court's ruling.
If we had filed the other version of the brief where we had said nothing on the merits, the chances that I stood at the lectern and got a whole bunch of merits questions that we hadn't briefed and hadn't run through an agency process and were ordered to do supplemental briefing, it's not like unreasonable.
That's why you file a conditional cross appeal. This is not alien stuff, but without an, you've told us it's not authorized by the Solicitor General. I don't know why we shouldn't strike that entire 2/3 of your brief, even if we get to the merits.
If you wanted to, you can also, if you wanted to view it as an amicus brief, you could. If you want to view it as whatever, this is the government's position. The court is free to consider it or not.
Well, I'm very concerned about this process issue, that this is just pretty settled law, and it seems like it's circumventing the rule of Solicitor General authorization for a decision. And the whole point of that process is to police when the government chooses to seek to overturn a district court's decision or not.
Yeah, I want to be careful about how I characterize internal government deliberations, but what I will say is that the Solicitor General decided not to pursue an appeal in this case.
That seems to
Two different deputies Solicitor General have also reviewed the various filings government's made.
Okay. But I think the fact that the Solicitor General chose not to appeal means that you are not allowed to argue for a change in the district court judgment. As if there's something wrong in my analysis, let me know.
The
Supreme Court said without SG authorization.
All I can say is that, you know, the SG wanted the views in the brief put before the court, and the court can consider those or not.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. The appeal should be dismissed. Thank you.
May it please the court, Erica Turrett for Indiana Medicaid beneficiaries Monty Rose Jr., Chelsea Lang, and Emily Rames. In 2020, the secretary approved an unprecedented 10-year extension of a Section 1115 project in Indiana. In doing so, he brushed aside years of uncontroverted record evidence demonstrating this same project had resulted in tens of thousands of low-income Hoosiers losing their Medicaid coverage. This morning, I have two key points I'd like to address. First, for the reasons the government stated and as explained in our brief, this panel is bound by this court's precedent dictating there is no jurisdiction over Indiana's appeal. As your questions to Indiana made clear, this is a routine occurrence for this court. This court's precedent is manifest in Indiana's arguments as to why it should be able to end run a categorical jurisdictional rule or unavailing. Second, if you do proceed to the merits, Judge Boasberg correctly determined the secretary failed to adequately consider Medicaid's core purpose of providing coverage to those who cannot otherwise afford it. That makes the secretary's approval arbitrary and capricious under the Administrative Procedure Act. This is the same textbook APA error the secretary made when he approved Arkansas' Section 1115 waiver, an approval this court held was arbitrary and capricious in Gresham v. Azar. There's been a lot of discussion about jurisdiction this morning, and unless this court has further questions, I'd like to address Judge Millett's questions about coverage loss to Indiana. If you look at JA 1200, it makes clear that between 2015 and 2016, 46,000 people in Indiana were never enrolled because they could not pay a premium. An additional 13,000 people in that period were terminated from their coverage for not paying premiums. That's a full 29%. Of people who could have been denied coverage were because of non-payment of premiums.
Please go ahead.
Then on JA 1029, we go into the data from 2017 to 2018. In that period, Judge Millett asked Indiana whether the state had looked at the number of people who were never enrolled but for not paying a premium. The state did not study that during that period, but for people who were actually terminated from coverage, it was an additional 26,000 people terminated for non-payment between 2017 and 2018.
Have there been any studies of... Because that's the one that involves HIP 2.0, that time period.
Sorry, Your Honor?
Is that second time period involves HIP 2.0? Do I have my dates right?
Yes, HIP 2.0 was approved in 2015. Right. So that whole time period covers HIP 2.0.
So, did it take effect in 2015 or 20? When you talk about statistics from 2015 to 2016, does that include HIP 2.0?
Yes, that's all under HIP 2.0.
Okay. All right. Why are there statistics of how many people were denied coverage in after 2016 to 2020, I guess?
Yes, we have statistics from 2015 to 2018. Mm-hmm. And we have some initial data from 2018 to 2020. But as Indiana indicated, that data is smaller. But numerous commenters alerted the secretary to the fact that the barriers posed by premiums continue to be present. And you'll also see that type of information in the amicus brief from the American Public Health Association.
And I had a question on with respect to the retroactive coverage issue. So Mr. Rose says he has medical debt from before he enrolled in HIP due to emergency room visits, but doesn't say whether any of those visits were in the 3-month period that would be covered by retroactive provision. And Ms. Rames says, if I'm saying her name correct, Rames has unpaid bills from before she was insured with HIP, but again, doesn't say that they were incurred within the 3-month period. So I'm trying to understand whether you have demonstrated standing as to that particular argument.
Correct, Your Honor. First, as Judge Boasberg explained, you don't need to reach that in order to find that the plaintiffs have standing to challenge HIP as a whole. But with respect to retroactive coverage in particular, if you look at someone like Ms. Rames, she could be terminated for nonpayment of premiums because her income is above 100% of the federal poverty line. Because she has ongoing health issues, that means that there's a substantial probability that if she were terminated, she would undergo expenses in the 3-month period following termination. So in our view, that's the correct way to view it.
So since there's no more lockout period, I thought if she gets terminated on Tuesday, she can apply again Wednesday.
Yes, Your Honor, but not if she can't afford to pay the premiums. Mm-hmm. If this waiver approval in totality, including with respect to premiums, were to go back into place, that would mean that someone like Ms. Rames would need to pay a premium in order to be back enrolled. And so our position is that if she cannot afford to pay premiums, she would go uninsured.
I think that goes to the premium requirement issue, but it sounds like you do not have at least a good faith allegation that either of them has medical bills that cover the actual 3-month period that preceded their enrollment.
Correct, Your Honor.
But so you're arguing, I guess, a substantial risk that if so far they've been paying their premiums and they're still in, but if in the future they can't, then they'll be kicked off and there's a risk of that. And then there's another risk that during that time period they're kicked off, they will incur medical bills.
Your Honor, to take a step back, the plaintiffs haven't had to pay premiums, as this court noted, for 5 years since 2020. So having to pay premiums now, again, would be a significant departure from the status quo and a significant expense. And, you know, no plaintiff could guarantee for sure that if terminated from coverage, that they would have certain expenses within that 3-month period. But we think under this court's precedent, if you have ongoing regular health needs that you frequently receive medical care for, then there's a substantial likelihood that within 3 months you would have that
precedent from this court.
I can do that, Your Honor.
Or you could send it later if you want. I don't want to delay things.
Yes, Your Honor. I would point to cases like NBXL Ray Peacock v. District of Columbia from 2012, and Association of American Physicians and Surgeons v. Sibelius from 2014.
Are those in your brief?
Sorry?
Are those in your brief?
Yes, on page 24 of our brief.
Got it. Thank you. Thank you very much. That's helpful. Why wouldn't, if you have, I'll ask you the same question on jurisdiction. If you have as here a cooperative state-federal program that produces a contract between two parties, U.S. government, state government, and that contract is vacated by a court order. And let's imagine it's hypothetical state X, and they have an experimental program to address treatment of particularly expensive types of cancer. And so because the cancer treatments are so expensive, maybe some of them experimental themselves, that they want to let people in who maybe have, they don't want to go limited. They want to expand the number of people that can be covered.
by this. And if vacature would terminate that experimental program. And so while the remand is ongoing, people are not receiving cancer treatments or some other thing in dialysis or life-saving prescription medications. Doesn't that warrant, isn't that about as practical a reason for recognizing finality as we could have?
Your Honor, taking a step back, I think it's important to keep in mind that with respect to vacatur here, that's the standard remedy under the APA when you remand. So if we were to treat vacatur, remand with vacatur and remand without vacatur differently, that would cut a huge hole in this court's precedent regarding non-final remand orders. I'll also say with respect to that hypothetical, I would consider this court's decision in Melinta Therapeutics. There, the FDA had approved a new drug. The district court vacated the approval and remanded the decision back to the agency. Nexus Pharmaceuticals, the intervener, came in and talked about all the harms. It would not only not be able to market the drug during remand, it said, but also that ill patients would go without access to the treatment, and this court still said no jurisdiction.
Yeah, but when the FDA makes an error in approving a drug, there may well be concerns with safety and effectiveness. There's no safety and effectiveness of a drug analysis or cancer treatments here. So I don't understand. It doesn't seem to be to present the same. That also wasn't a cooperative state program. Was like, you can't take the government's side of the contract down without taking Indiana's side down as well. And so if they actually came forward and made a showing, people will die or people will have extraordinary health impairments. We have this remand rule. And that's not final enough. You can talk about that on your appeal later.
Your Honor, we don't think that vacatur is determinative of the jurisdictional question, and this court has never viewed remand orders differently on that basis. We also think it's important to consider that here this is about a Section 1115 approval. It's not about the underlying Medicaid agreement between the federal government and the state. As the federal government indicated, that would be the state plan. So it's not as if vacating a Section 1115 approval disturbs the underlying Medicaid program.
My hypothetical would disturb this program, and the state's going to come forward and say, this is hugely consequential.
Understood, Your Honor. And we think this court's rule is that a remand order that returns the core dispute to the agency to reconsider the decision for significant further proceedings is a categorical rule. We think practicality considerations are baked into the court's exceptions. And in your hypothetical, I don't see one of those exceptions applying.
We haven't recognized an exception like this yet, but initially we hadn't at all. And then we recognized one for the government. And then we recognized one for, the government agency is not going to do anything, so they won't be able to appeal later. So we have recognized practical exceptions. Have we said that list has been exhausted?
No, Your Honor, but the government's exception is based on the idea that it will never be able to appeal its efforts to comply with the remand order, and the practical exceptions all are in cases where the core dispute was not returned to the agency for further proceedings or the agency wasn't going to act. So you in the dialogue with Indiana explained that this court has said that if the agency concedes at oral argument, for example, that they're not going to act, that that would warrant an exception. And that's what happened in In Re Long Distance Telephone, for example. So in all those cases where practicality as an exception has been baked in or recognized by this court, it's instances where the agency was not going to reconsider the decision on remand and where the court left discretionary room for the agency to act.
Questions? All right. Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Stuart Gardo, we will give you 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. 2 points, one on jurisdiction, one on coverage. On jurisdiction, all parties accept that this court would have jurisdiction over the appeal if the government had filed a notice of appeal. We think that same rule should apply to states where there is a decision impacting cooperative federalism program. They're just as affected by the federal government, if not more so by any decision, and like the government, face the prospect of not being able to appeal if, for example, on remand, there's a new decision and for whatever reason, the plaintiffs decide not to challenge it. I don't think that because of that parity, I don't think the stay factors into this analysis, but I would also just remind the court that if the stay is going, the partial stay is going to factor in, that does create a perverse incentive to seek disruption to create jurisdiction. On the coverage point, all the data that was the plaintiffs have talked about was either before 2018. That overlooks that as page 882 of the joint appendix notes, there was a substantial restructuring of the power account structure in 2018. That means you can't rely on pre-2018 data. And while there was an expectation that the secretary expressed on pages 755 and 756 that this issue would continue to be studied, at the time the approval issued, we now were into the COVID era where due to both special COVID era rules, as well as just the general dissimilarity in circumstances in society where it was not possible to continue testing this aspect of the program until COVID ended. I think that's—
Have you resumed testing since COVID ended?
We have not been able to, Your Honor.
Not been able to or just haven't?
We have not been able to because the special COVID era rules sort of lasted right up until we got the district court's decision in this case. And then at that point,
special COVID funding.
So there was special COVID legislation that says states could not disenroll.
There wasn't a reason you couldn't have done a study.
Based on funding that was accepted at the beginning of COVID, there was no longer any contributions to power accounts being charged during that period. So the issue, there wasn't a factual material to
financial
study.
Financial decision.
Correct. And then at that, when COVID, those rules ended, we had the district court's decision that vacated the portions of the waiver that would be needed to implement those contributions and therefore have data to test.
Okay. And then did you just say that the data from 2018 to 2019, years after HIP 2.0 was adopted, doesn't track the operation of HIP 2.0? I'm sorry.
Pre-2018 data, which is all the data that the plaintiffs are pointing to, can't be used to assess HIP 2.0 post-2018 because in 2018, there were major structural changes done to power accounts that had the effect of lowering premiums to $1 for about half of the population, and that simplified the whole structure to address some of the concerns that commenters had raised about sort of the pre-2018 operation. Mm-hmm.
Any questions? All right. Thank you so much to all counsel. The case is submitted.